welcome to episode 2 of the Daggers and Lids podcast. It's great to have your company wherever you're listening or watching us on YouTube. We thoroughly enjoyed the reaction to our first podcast. So thank you for everybody for getting in touch and for listening and downloading. You can download them on any podcast platform or pretty much every podcast platform. I'm just happy that it worked and I pressed all the right buttons and you were available to listen. So absolutely delighted with that. I'm Charles Dagnall. Lydia Greenway, former England international. How are you?
I'm good. I feel like we're in the swing of things now. We've had a bit of sunshine over the weekend, which is nice. Always welcome.
Yes.
I know you had a nice day yesterday, a bit of a barbecue. And
oh, yes. We had.
To be done.
We had. So my partner, Asha's friend, who she works with, her husband is the sommelier. He's the wine guy for Harrods. And he brought over like 3 or 4 wines. So I don't remember much after about 6 or 7 o'clock of yesterday, but I'm sure we all had a really good time. But thankfully, I cooked on the barbecue prior to having those wines. So anything after 6 o'clock, I don't really remember. You had a nice day as well, family and friends.
I did, yeah. Went down to see my mum and dad and my brother, his children, his wife as well. We were all sort of in the garden playing, which was nice. We had the Sunday off. But back to it today, obviously. Back to the grind.
Back to the grind, back to cricket. Yeah. And again, we thank you for all of your comments. Now, a couple of bits of housekeeping to bring you up to date with. Now, one thing about the podcast, yes, we want to speak to England players. Yes, we want to speak to England coaches. And later on, we are going to hear from Matt Mason, the England women's bowling coach, which we're hugely looking forward to. But we also want to try and get as much of a variety of content within the women's game as we possibly can. So one thing, and I've been noticing this, as have you, especially on social media, is the rise, and going around the country as well, especially last year, the rise of women's cricket clubs or cricket clubs who have started women's sections. And we're going to try and spotlight one or two of them each week. Now, we want you to get in touch with us. Now, in due course, we'll have an email address that you can let us know all about your club. We can read that out. Or you can get in touch with us on social media. Get in touch with at Charles Dagnall or at Lydia Greenway. If you are a cricket club that has just started or have got a very well-established women's section, then we want to hear from you and celebrate that, hear about some of the characters, what you've been doing within the women's game. So you can do it via social media. We will get an email address that you can do that. But even better, Lids, because we're on YouTube and we're doing this as a video podcast, what we would love is to see you guys within the cricket club. So if you make us a little, I don't know, sort of 2-minute video of you at the cricket club, we can put it into the video as part of the podcast. But we want to celebrate this. One team who I do know have got a thriving women's section, and I've been following their progress, Ramsbottom Cricket Club up in Lancashire, where I'm originally from, just down the road, have started playing, the women's team have started playing within the men's league, which I think is a fantastic story. And we're hopefully speak about them, but that's just one club. I'm sure there are hundreds around the country.
Yeah, there's loads. Like I'm lucky to spend a lot of time working in women's clubs, going to schools as well, and there's just so many. So yeah, absolutely, let's hear from as many of you as possible.
Send us your videos, okay, and we'll find you a way to get that to happen. And if you do send us a video, try and do it landscape, not portrait. That would be great. Because let's be honest, I'm editing it together, so that would just assist me hugely. Right. Before we hear from Matt Mason, we have news. I feel we need a sort of news jingle.
A jingle.
We need a jingle. Shall I try and source one for the next episode?
Yeah, I think you should. That sort of comes under your producer remit, doesn't it?
It does really, doesn't it? I will source us a news jingle, and then we can sort of build it up and make it big and noisy. Yeah, absolutely. You can play that role. I think that would be sensational. So we've got one bit of news, and then Lydia will try and keep her. Charlotte, Ed, I'm going to get you. I will. I'm going to get you a music.
I've got a complex now after last week.
Look. I realise it was beautifully done. I would say just 5 or 6 minutes too long. That's all I'm saying.
The people want to know how Eve Jones has done.
As do we all. As do we all. So I'm going to get you a little musical bed as well to do your Charlotte Edwards Cup roundup over. We actually, there isn't a great deal of news to go out at the moment. And obviously, the Charlotte Edwards Cup is going on at the moment. But one thing that did stick out was that Bryony Smith is the first player, or the first player that I can see, that has signed a professional contract for next season. So remember, the franchise model is now going. The women's side are going to be, they have got tier status and are going to be aligned with the counties. And Bryony Smith has signed for Surrey. Now, she, for next year, Surrey are one of the sides that have that tier one status. She's going to be team captain, as well, a Surrey girl. And I can imagine, Lids, that A, we'll talk about the signing in a second, but I reckon this is the first of a lot of these types of contracts going to be announced relatively soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the 1st of June was the day in which the players could start looking at contracts that they can sign moving forwards and obviously into the new structure. So, yeah, really exciting. And I like that Surrey have gone with Bryony, because she's obviously been a Surrey girl through and through. She's come through the pathway there, and she's leading the side really well at the moment. I think they're unbeaten at the moment in the Charlotte Edwards Cup. So, yeah, good signing for them. And I suppose Surrey are in a nice position that they have an existing structure in place. Mm. So there's not too much uncertainty. I think they've already announced who their director of women's cricket will be as well in Emma Calvert, who is already in post. So counties like Surrey, like Warwickshire, are in really strong positions because they've already got that structure. But yeah, going back to Bryony, it's a great signing for them.
And the other reason I think it's a really good signing is that, and this is no disrespect to Bryony, I know I'm sure she still has international aspirations, she's only 26 years old, but I also think that those players who are on the fringes of England's side are going to be available. They're going to be available for a lot of the Rachel Hayhoe Flint, a lot of the Charlotte Edwards Cup. And those types of players are going to be worth, you know, really worth pursuing. And I think Surrey have made a very smart move.
Yes, yeah, I agree. That's a great point as well. Someone like Eve Jones would be a good signing as well.
So. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure we'll get to. We might just have a section of how has Eve Jones done. Love Eve. Absolutely love her. I've enjoyed watching her play for a long time, but I think we should have a complete subsection of what's Eve Jones done this week. She could talk about getting a complex. She would have a complex on that if we have that particular topic on the podcast. Just one thing I wanted to mention as well. Sophie Eccleston. This came up on social media. Sophie Eccleston, not only did she play for the Lancashire Thunder on Sunday, but she rocked up for Alvanley Cricket Club First 11 on the Saturday, played with her brother, Jimmy. Yeah. She ends up, I think it's the Cheshire League Division 2, against Bollington Cricket Club, 10 overs, 3 maidens, 5 for 12. That's just what you want to see at the weekend, isn't it? The world's number one bowler just rocking in for 10 overs in a club game.
I love that, though. But good on her Brilliant. For playing as well, isn't 100%. It? For being on our high horses about some of the girls not playing. But that's brilliant. Really good from her. And you know she's always going to do well, isn't she, in those sorts of games. But yeah,
unbelievable. Brilliant. The Ecclestons took 8 wickets between them. Jimmy got 3 as well. So Bollington, poor Bollington, have been Eccleston'd against Alvanley Cricket Club. Well, it's that time of the podcast where we round up what's happened in the Charlotte Edwards Cup. Over to you, Lydia Greenway.
You can go and make yourself a cup of tea, Daggers. I might need glasses, you know. This is actually quite hard to read. Right, I'm just going to do a really quick wrap-up. So games that happened at the weekend. The first one was on Friday. We were down there at Taunton, Daggers.
We were.
Western Storm, they defended 134 to beat Sunrisers. good to see Lauren Filer with ball in hand, as and Izzy Wong there. And then yesterday, which was Sunday the 2nd, Northern Diamonds lost again, so they've not got a win yet in the Charlotte Edwards Cup. They lost to the Sunrisers. Southeast Stars also unbeaten along with the Blaze. The Southeast Stars managed to beat the Southern Vipers by 6 wickets. That was at the Oval. And then the Blaze, who, as I mentioned, unbeaten, had a good win over the Thunder, and that was at Old Trafford. Couple of performances to note. Kirsty Gordon, 5 for 12 for the Blaze against the Thunder. And then Grace Scrivens as well, 64 not out in their chase against the Diamonds. That's better, isn't it?
That's good. That's, did you actually, I can't remember, did you actually tell us how Eve Jones did?
Oh, no, I didn't because, no, I didn't.
You see, you picked it up and you've not even mentioned poor Eve. We'll have to get Eve on, and well, maybe she can send us a video and just sort of say, hi, Daggers and Lids, I got 34 today and fielded really well. And then we'll just slide that in.
We'll have to get a little voice memo or something. Yeah. Or actually say a video. There we go.
Well, thank you for that. We are rounded up in the Charlotte Edwards Cup, and we will keep across that, of course, over the course of the season. Right, let's get to our main part of the podcast. We have England bowling coach Matt Mason joining us for this second edition of the podcast. Firstly, Matt, where the hell are you? You are not within... I expected to see an office full of leather-bound books and sort of pie charts and statistics all around you, but it looks like you're in the garden.
I do most of my best work outdoors, Daggers. I'm not one for an office or being stuck inside four walls, so I'm in my natural habitat. But truth be told, I've moved house recently. I don't have any Wi-Fi, so this is the best place. I mean, to be fair, I had a meeting this morning. I was halfway up this tree behind me to try and get a signal, so we've done well.
Well, bless you for your time, and we thank you for that. Of course, and we go way back when you used to take my wicket for fun back in the county days, which is not necessarily the biggest feather in a bowler's cap, I will admit. But your role now with the England women's team, and it's been for quite some time, actually. How long have you been in the job?
About 18 months now. So, yeah, it's my first sort of full-time role in a women's program. About 18 months. So I have done little bits and pieces over the course of my coaching career, of course. But, 18 months, and it's been an amazing adventure so far.
How's that been? I mean, the transition, obviously, coaching from men's teams to women's teams. I mean, was it a big difference to make?
I'm still learning, I think, to be totally honest with you. When I say learning, I'm talking more about coaching female fast bowlers more specifically. There are some obvious differences, but generally coaching is about people, isn't it? So I've actually found the transition into women's game more to my liking. I really enjoy the way the girls build relationships, which is I'm big on as a coach. So I have to say that I'm probably really in my favourite environment at the moment.
Just nice. just on that as well, before we get properly stuck in, you have listened to the first edition of the podcast, and that's why we're really grateful for you for coming on. And you sent me a message saying, I've got my gum shielded ready, because we did discuss lots of topics. So he's got his hard hat on and gum shield. And of course, there is, you know, what we discussed in the first edition of the podcast about the workloads and about player availability and all of that. You know, it's comes from a good place. I'm sure you understand it comes from a good place and the questions. So, Lids, take us over.
Well, obviously, I guess following up from the podcast that we started with, I suppose one of the themes that came out of it was around availability of the England players and perhaps not always playing in the domestic games where maybe they could do. And I think that comes more from a place of us seeing what we think is happening, whereas we know that that isn't always the case. So I suppose the first thing that I guess would be good to start with is from obviously your point of view, the coach's point of view, how do you manage the availability of the England players when it comes to obviously the Rachel Hayhoe Flint, which was at the start of the season, and now more recently the Charlotte Edwards Cup. I'm guessing from Heather's answer, it is very much individual, but I suppose how do you get to those decisions?
It certainly is individual, Lids. And can I start by saying that I have listened to you guys discuss this during the commentary in the ODI series, which I stepped back from for that series. So I was able to sit on my sofa and listen and watch. And I have to say that I'm in agreement with you in terms of the importance of the domestic game. And of course, we want to make our girls available as often as we can. But obviously, behind the scenes, it's far more complex than that. It's very much about working through every single individual, what that player needs at that given time, and what that player's long-term development looks like also. As you know, the modern game is far busier than it used to be. There's a lot of cricket now. 12 months of the year, these girls, we're having to program them for, and we've got to look ahead to things as far ahead as the Ashes, obviously, which is a massive series for us in the new year in Australia. So we almost have to work back from these time points. And sometimes that means making some short-term decisions as well that have the best interest of that player at the centre of it. And that might be from a physical point of view, it might be from a skills point of view, it might be from a well-being point of view. But how those decisions are worked through is actually quite thorough. We meet every Monday morning as a fast bowling group. And I'll talk to the fast bowlers here because it's more specific to my role. But, you know, we've got a wonderful science and medicine team, one of the best I've ever worked with. And with those guys on a call, there's probably 8 or 9 of us sat around a table or sitting online discussing each individual. And sometimes those meetings take 2 to 3 hours. And out of that, we make some decisions. And those decisions are often based around what does the next week look like? What do the future fixtures look like? And what is the best thing for that player at the time? Because we need them available and at their best for England fixtures, obviously, first and foremost. Now, if we can afford them the opportunity to go back to their region, we'd like them to do that for many reasons. One, it's a great place to go and play your cricket. And two, spread the word of the England team throughout your region. We don't underestimate the impact that our senior England women have on their regions. And at any given time, there are England players playing. But I also understand sometimes where you guys might think, well, you know, where are these England players? Why aren't they being seen more readily? But it's not without good thought and good processes. And that's why we come up with these decisions.
And what about, I suppose, one thing I think is quite unique to women's cricket and maybe women's sport in a whole is actually the sense of responsibility of growing the game together as well. So obviously with the new domestic structure coming in from next year, I suppose from that point of view, and then also from an England point of view and the connection that is built from a standing start, really, making sure that the domestic structure is as good as it can be. How much, I suppose, does that also come into your thinking as a coach in making sure that when you look at Australia and they have got the best domestic structure in place, how much thinking do you also do about that from a bigger point of view?
We do a lot of that, actually. I mean, when John Lewis came in to take on this role, his sort of one of his big visions, if you like, is to grow and change the women's game. And that's not lost on the playing group. Most of the time, and I have to say this, the girls don't make those decisions. We consult with the girls. But often it's not that they don't want to play for their regions. It's that we decide as a professional group of, I suppose, experts in our field with consultation that maybe this isn't the right time for you to play for your region, or maybe that it is. So I want to make sure that everyone's aware that the girls do support their regions, and if anything, sometimes we have to make the tough call for them not to play. They want to grow the game, and they don't just do that by taking the field for their regions. They do that in so many other ways. I mean, they're so present. I've never seen a group of cricketers spend so much time post a game with their fans, spending time out to talk to families, to young children about the game. They do everything they possibly can in their power to grow the game. Sometimes we take that decision out of their hands because we know that as professional cricketers in this environment they're in, that is the best decision at the time. So we absolutely have a responsibility to grow the game. And I think going forward, as we learn more about the tolerance of the women and playing more and more cricket, that we actually will see them play more and more domestic cricket, assuming that the international calendar allows it.
Mace, do you ever give the women a choice to play or to not to play, or is that decision made for them all the time?
I think Daggers, more often than not, everything we should try and make a choice where we can. It's normally a discussion, and we try and show them perhaps the positives and the negatives of any decision. And often it can be left to the player to make that call. There are often things that I'm not privy to as well going on in the girls' lives, because we have to remember these girls have a lot more going on than just their cricket in their world. So we have to consider all sorts of factors, not just the cricket. And sometimes the decisions will be made for personal reasons, not necessarily cricketing reasons, and we have to be okay with that. But more often than not, I'd say the advice that we provide them with is based purely on what we feel is in the best long-term benefit for that player and growing our team and growing them. So I'd say more often than not, it's probably our decision. We've had incidences, mate, as you can imagine, where the girls are kicking and screaming when we tell them they can't go and play for the region, because they all love turning out and playing cricket. But they're also new to being professional. To give you an example, Danny Gibson's only been a professional cricketer for about a year. Lauren Filer, not much longer. So we're having to educate them too on managing themselves, and they just can't possibly play every single game as much as they want to.
Do you think there could be then in that case? So because obviously we see things. We're not within the inner sanctum of the England dressing room or England team. We just say what we see, and we obviously form opinions, etc. But could there be slightly better communication, do you feel, to reason why X has been left out, or Y is not playing for the Sunrisers, or Z is having a break from cricket altogether? Because obviously, you know, we look at the cold hard stats of it and look at, you know, certain players who have played very, very little domestic cricket, and we wonder why.
That's a really good point, Daggers, and I think you're probably right in some regard. I mean, obviously, we communicate a lot with the regions. John Lewis, our head coach, the science and medicine team, you know, the communication back to the regions is always very, very good. And granted, they get frustrated. I know that they often would like to see their domestic players. Sometimes those decisions have to be made quite late, which can be very frustrating. I totally get it. But sometimes also when we make a player available at late notice, that can also cause disruption, because some young player is going to have to step out of that 11 to make way for their England players. So I do think the communication piece is important. I think to the wider public, there are possibly some things we could share, maybe more around fitness and things like that. But yeah, also those decisions are made by a group sort of sit far more lofty than I. But I think it probably depends on the nature of what we're talking about and whether players are comfortable with that information going out there. But you're right, there's probably scope maybe to look at that and think, rather than have speculation, sometimes being more forthright with what we say might be useful.
Yeah, I think Daggers and I, before you came on, mate, we were talking about, we obviously cover the Blast, the men's games as well. And when we're doing like our previewing and trying to get some information, often they sort of do the press releases, which explains why the England players aren't available or another player's got injured. And maybe that's just part of moving the game forwards for the regions, is just actually having that communication out there as to why they're not playing. But Mace, one thing I mentioned to you before we started recording that I'm really interested in, and I think you've already mentioned it as well, is the game maybe is still getting used to what tolerance levels fast bowlers have when it comes to female fast bowlers. So I'm interested to know from your experience, maybe the differences when you have like a young Lauren Bell and maybe someone like a Gus Atkinson, who are potentially at similar stages of their career, but on the outside, it looks like Gus Atkinson has an ability to tolerate a lot more in terms of workloads and overs under his belts compared to someone like Lauren Bell. So I suppose, I guess, just your thoughts on that, really, as a statement, really. Why would that be, and what can you do as a fast bowling coach?
Yeah, I think the first thing, there's a couple of things that stand out straight away. That's the more obvious thing to do now, I think, with how long the men play cricket. And by that, I mean their junior years are generally much higher volumes. They come through academies, they come through possibly a different system than a Lauren Bell maybe has done. So by the time they reach sort of that academy, end of the academy life into county cricket, they might spend some time playing some three-day cricket with their second team, dabbling in some four-day cricket as well as they sort of find their feet in the county game. And by design, they end up being far more resilient. If I plucked a figure on sort of average, you're probably talking you've got 40 to 45 overs a week where you find the guys can probably sit quite comfortably. The girls are less than half that. Some of our girls' tolerances are as low as 16 to 18 overs a week. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've got two sort of 50-over games for your region in that week, you've already exceeded your tolerance, and that's without even training. So what that makes very difficult, and this will lead on to another point, which is I know Daggers is quite strong, and why are we seeing the girls trying some of these changes in matches? It's because we don't have the overs. So we're simply having to do work on the coalface. And that's nobody's fault. That's just the way that the professional game, being quite late to the girls, has left them. If you think of Freya Kemp making her debut at 16 in an ODI, that was her first ever 50-over game of cricket in her life. That would never happen in the men's game. They would have far longer to experience and become resilient, more strength and conditioning, more support over a longer period of time. Some of these girls are having to learn not only their skills, but to build their resilience, their tolerance, their fitness levels, learn the game tactically. They're having to do all this while under the scrutiny of international cricket because their talent pool is obviously quite small, particularly in fast bowling. So we do have some unique challenges that the girls having to sort of contend with that the men perhaps don't. We can sometimes be talking the difference of sort of 2,000-3,000 overs over that early period. That the lads have an advantage over the girls. So what we are trying to do, though, Lids, as I can tell you now, is we're trying to shift that. We're trying to make our girls far more resilient. But you have to do it at a certain pace. If we go too quickly with this, we'll start to injure our girls and we don't have this huge depth of fast bowling talent we can afford for that to happen. So over the next sort of 12 to 18 months, I think we'll start to see the girls' workloads increasing. We'll start to see them being able to maybe fit some training overs in and around games so we can do that work that we're talking about and still trying to make them available for domestic cricket and then play all the international series as well. So it's a slow process. We'd all like it to happen tomorrow, but the reality is that it can't. I mean, even with some of the male bowlers I've coached, if you push them too fast, they won't tolerate the load. So that's why you see a Kate Cross now who's nearer to 30 than to 20, far more resilient, can bowl nearly 25 to 30 overs a week at a canter, whereas a Freya Kemp or a Lauren Filer is still down around the 16 to 18. So you can see how our coaching hours are restricted by the number of balls available.
Absolutely. And I totally understand where you're coming from, Mace. I absolutely do. I got accused this week of being old school on social media today, and I took a little bit of an offence to that. Because it's not an old school methodology to actually try things that you are or using the domestic structure to better yourself in a variety of different ways, I believe. And I think there is still no substitute. And you've been in the game just as long as we have. I think there is no substitute for spending time in the middle. So I look at some of the batters and who have barely played any innings prior to that Pakistan series, or the bowlers who are working on things and are having to do that during the Pakistan series. This is kind of what domestic cricket was surely set up for. There was a time where there was a complaint that there was not enough domestic cricket played, and now they've got a situation where there is a full 14-game schedule in 50-over cricket and T20 cricket. So could the balance, rather than necessarily training or match days, I mean, you know, you as a bowler would have spent a long time sort of trying to get the rhythm going rather than, so you're hitting the ground running when it comes to a certain international series or a World Cup, and that's kind of what the domestic structure is for. I mean, I don't understand any batter, say, and there are a couple within the England side who have got maybe two innings under their belt in the middle prior to an international series.
Yeah, it's a point well made, Daggers, to be fair. And I can't talk too much to the batting side of things, but I totally get your point around Why wouldn't they be sort of using the domestic structure to further themselves? I totally get that. I guess the point is as well that we're trying to put our best team out there as often as we can. And in discussion with the players, we challenge them a little bit around this stuff. You know, are you prepared to go into an international fixture when you're still one of our best bowlers and work on something new, or you're one of our best players? Because, yes, you might be working on something technical, for example, but by, as you rightly said, by going out there and experiencing it in the moment, in the game, and putting it under pressure, which we have to test it, it might not always go quite so well, granted, but we still feel the benefits far outweigh the potential downside to that, because every little change that we make is really, really important that it's tested under pressure. We can't recreate that pressure in training. Yes, technical change can be difficult. Any sort of change can be, but it's not done without the consultation of the girls. So, for example, I'll give you Lauren Bell, as we've documented. Yeah. If Lauren Bell decided that she did not want to play those fixtures because of the technical change we're making, then we would have to have that discussion and potentially leave Lauren Bell out of those games. But someone like a Lauren Bell, who's really determined and really brave, I think, said, I'd much rather play for England. There's no point me not doing it in a game, because then I'm just practicing bad habits and the change will never land. So I'm going to take it into the middle, except that I might get a few things wrong, and which is really brave, because we know they get judged out there. But we also saw some real positives. And if I could tell you that she came off all those games absolutely buzzing because she did some really great things that we've been working on, we see that as coaches as massive growth. Yes, it doesn't always look perfect, and yes, it's elite level and all those things, but I think with cricket and our situation is a little bit unique. We can't really afford to pull all the players out that we're trying to develop and send them back to domestic cricket and miss games for England, because we just don't have that depth at the moment to be able to do that. But I think we will in the future.
Thanks, mate. Really appreciate you sort of answering these questions. But we'll move on, because we've got, well, it feels like talking points that come up in, again, women's sport and particularly women's cricket. And we'll stick to bowling because this is obviously your bread and butter. But your thoughts, firstly, on pitch lengths. So one question that we get asked, well, people sort of put forward a lot is, why don't the women bowl on or play on shorter length pitches? And then also the ball size, which for me, that is more interesting, I think. But we'll start off with pitch lengths and what you think. If the women should play on shorter pitches, if you do, why would you say? If not, what would be your reasons?
Oh, look, I think if there's any scope for short pitches, it's where we see it sometimes in the junior men's as well. It's the younger age groups when they're really young and they're struggling to cope with the nature of a bowling action, and they, you know, they get their bodies into certain positions just to try and get the ball down there in one bounce. And they unfortunately end up learning poor habits and poor techniques. I think the girls can cope with a full-size pitch. I've seen it. I mean, I watch the girls bowl. I take a mitt to Lauren Filer. I wouldn't fancy facing Lauren Filer, to be honest with you, over 22 yards.
20 yards, yeah.
You know, I absolutely believe when I watch these girls, especially having been involved back when you were, Liz, in 2012, I did a little bit. And the pace the girls bowl at now, the athletes that they are, they can absolutely cope with a full length pitch. I actually think they could potentially play on bigger boundaries soon, the way they hit the ball as well. I have absolutely no problem with them playing on the conditions that they do now. In fact, I think sometimes the game's harder with the smaller fielding circle, the only four out at the death. I've got nothing but admiration for the way they go about their business.
Always been a batter's game.
and
the ball size. So, yeah, the reason I find this one interesting is I was speaking to Catherine Siver-Brunt, and she felt that she's not so worried about the weight of the ball, but she felt that if the circumference of the ball was smaller, then as a seam bowler, she felt that she would have been able to have got perhaps more movement through the air, but also off the pitch. And also the same for spin bowlers as well. If they've got a smaller ball in their hand, they have the opportunity to be more skillful, to get more revs on the ball. So again, just your thoughts really on that as a potential change in the game, if you think it would be a good one.
Yeah, I heard something around this recently. It was certainly discussed. I think I'm right in saying that the ball, the female ball, is only 3% smaller in size to the men. But yeah, I think on average, hand size is about 10 to 15% difference. So you can see how it might be a challenge. And certainly one of the great skills to get movement on the ball, whether it be spin or swing, is imparting spin on the ball. So you need the ball to be in contact with your fingers as long as possible. And if you've only got small hands, that can be more difficult. Now, I wouldn't like to say or speculate too much, but we don't see too many female spinners absolutely ripping the ball hugely. But then someone like a Charlie Dean and a Soph still get plenty of revs on it. So they could probably answer that more effectively. I get Catherine's point. I see a lot of seam bowlers still wobbling the ball when it comes out the hands. Whether that's a factor, I don't know. It could just be that they haven't dedicated enough time to that skill yet. So jury's out for me a little bit. You know, I watch someone like a Freya Camp or even a Lauren Bell. At their best, they stand the seam up beautifully, actually, and get sometimes prodigious swings. So, yeah, I'm not sure where I sit on that one, Lids. At the moment, I think it's okay, but the spinners would probably be more impacted than the seamers would be my guess.
Yeah.
Just finally, Mason, and again, we've kept you on for 25 minutes, and we're really grateful to you for your time, and also knowing full well you've just moved house and the hedge behind you needs trimming. As one of the many jobs, I'm sure you've got.
That's my grapevine daggers.
Is that right? Can we see the Chateau Neuf de Mason coming out very
soon?
That
is soon.
Just a sort of quick fire hit, really, because we look at fast bowlers. That is your remit, and the four. And I know there are more, but probably the four that we look at are Lauren Filer, Lauren Bell, Izzy Wong, and Mahika Gore. So we have mentioned on commentary that you're working on things with Lauren Bell to try and adjust her foot position at the crease, so she's anchored a little bit longer and she can start to develop the away swinger, which we saw actually in a couple of instances in the One Day International series just recently. What about the others? What about Izzy Wong? Because she's gone through some difficult periods over the last 12 months as well, after being the poster child for England and after such a great bursting onto the scene and with England and the WPL, she struggled for a long bit. How do you, I'm not asking for any trade secrets or anything like that. I'm sort of basically, how do you manage that process into getting someone like her back? How much are you doing with Mahika Gore? Because she's obviously had A-levels that she's had to deal with and her schooling. And Lauren Filer as well, to try and get the most express pace. Do you all have sort of different plans for each of those bowlers?
Yeah, definitely, Daggers. We have a lot of individual plans for each bowler. They've all got different strengths, different attributes, and different things we want to add to their games. What's been a game changer for me in my role is we've brought Chris Liddell in, who you might have seen during the ODI series. Yeah. So having a second set of eyes and hands, if you like, to help me with the bowling group, because not only have we got our contracted group, we've got to keep an eye on the groups below, the 19s, the A side, and it's just too much for one person to do. So having Lid's expertise in the room has been really useful, and he's spent quite a lot of time dealing with Lauren Filer. He's done some great work with Lauren around her accuracy. So what we have seen with Lauren, she's kept her pace, but we've definitely seen that she's far more accurate than she used to be. And we all get excited when Lauren gets the ball in hand. Things happen, as we saw in those few overs in Taunton. So for Lauren, it's about building her confidence and her consistency. And then once that's in place and she feels, I guess, more comfortable in her ability to put the ball where she wants it, we can add some skill. She can swing it. She can swing it both ways. But she needs to first build that sort of confidence in her best delivery at this stage. And, you know, Lids is working really, really hard with Lauren. Mahika Gore, you're absolutely right. Love Mahika, the way she does things. 6'1", 18 years old, swings the ball back to the right-hander. We're doing some work with her to try and untap a bit more ball speed. But again, like everything, we have to do it at the right pace because we don't want her to be getting injured, and we have to manage her around school because she's still doing her A-levels and all that sort of stuff. So, and that's where we have to put the person first. So I spend a lot of time chatting with Mahika and just checking in with her. You'll have to get her on one day, get her to show you her magic tricks. She's got three amazing magic tricks. Magic Meeks, we call her. She'll kill me for saying that. And then obviously Izzy, as you know, Izzy's a wonderful talent and a wonderful person. And I think going back a few years ago, that bursting onto the scene, when you look at it in isolation, probably put under a huge amount of pressure. Really did put under pressure. And so we have to work really hard on the last sort of 12 to 18 months, trying to get Izzy in a place where she feels confident again, comfortable in her run-up, and just playing some cricket and finding that love of the game. Because when it's tough sometimes and you're under that much scrutiny as she is, and going and playing these big tournaments, it can be quite a tough place to be. As we saw last summer, we did quite a lot of work with her. She pushed really, really hard to be given an opportunity to play an international game. It didn't go the way she wanted, the game down at Chelmsford last year. Yeah. And on the back of that, though, some really great things happened. And that's a good example sometimes, isn't it, of when things that happen at the coalface, it gives you a way in to start doing some real work because it brings it to life. And she's been awesome. She just needs to bowl some overs. That's why I'm so pleased she's gone on loan, so she gets the opportunity that she needs. And I don't think she'll be too far away, to be honest. She just needs to play some cricket. And then obviously we've got a few youngsters in the background, and we've got lots going on, actually. There's certainly a lot to be excited about for the future of this bowling group. Like I said at the start, we just have to be a little bit patient because we can't just push them like we do with the guys. One, because they're so young, and two, we're still finding out so much about them because they are different to coach.
Well, look, we are, again, are hugely grateful for your time. We've learnt a lot over the course of the last half hour as well, and it'll be good to see you when we do during the New Zealand series. But thanks so much for your time. Get back to work. You've got cupboards to build, flat pack furniture to sort out, lawns to mow. So we're hugely grateful for your time.
That's okay. And just, that's all right, Liz. And just before I go, I just want to say to you guys that we really do appreciate the support that you two have for us. The girls do as well. And I know that comes sometimes with a bit of challenge, and we're okay with that. And it's great to have the opportunity to come and explain a little bit more to you guys, because I know that we're all just want to push the game forward. So thanks to you both as well for your support for the game.
Oh, that's lovely of you. That's lovely to hear, and we thank you for that. And good luck for the New Zealand series, and we look forward to seeing you then.
Thanks, guys. See you again soon.
How brilliant to have Matt Mason join us. And Liz, do you know what? I was really sort of, I was so pleased that he agreed to come on and stuff like that, because we don't want a separation between them and us. We obviously want to try and find out as much as we can, because that's part of our job, but also to inform everybody what's going on. But it was great to listen to what he had to say.
It was, and I really enjoyed listening to him. He's obviously brilliant at what he does. And I think the one thing that probably gave me more clarity is around the workload management of the bowlers. And that's something that's been sort of in the back of my mind. I can understand that. They don't have as many overs to work with. So you can completely understand what they're trying to do. Clearly, moving forward, that has to get to a point where it's increasing over time, because these players need to get better. They need to be playing more cricket. I suppose from a batter's point of view, why some of the girls aren't playing as much domestic cricket, and obviously Matt can answer that as well, because it's not in his role or his remit, I suppose that's probably still a bit of a question mark. I don't know what
I ask you, as a former professional batter, if you were playing for England, and the setup is as it is now, where there was, I think, four or five Rachel Hayhoe Flint trophy games, you're building up to an international summer. Would you want to spend five innings at the cricket, even if you're not getting any, but that time in the middle, match situation, that ruthlessness and hunger for runs to get yourself in the best form possible? Now, that would be the way I would see it.
But yeah.
Is that the way that you would work?
Yeah, 100%. I think most batters, you ask them, how do you get better? You get better from time in the middle, learning your game, playing in proper situations. And I think over the years, in the women's game particularly, we've produced really good trainers. We've produced people who are brilliant in the match scenarios. We've all been in those scenarios where it's like, well, that was two because it's gone out to the boundary and I'm running with Danny Wyatt at the other end, so she's always going to come back for two. So in those training scenarios, you become really good at them. But suddenly when you're in a match situation, that's where sometimes you can get caught out a bit. But yeah, just going back to what Matt was saying, I think he spoke a lot of sense. I mean, I don't know if you agree with that, because I think, as he said, the perception that we have sometimes is often down to a lack of knowing the reasoning and all those sorts of things. So yeah, it was good to sort of clear up quite a few things.
Absolutely. Well, we're hoping that this is the high quality caliber of guest that we will get on pretty much every time that we do the Daggers and Lids podcast. Great. We're finishing up, but we have a melancholy sort of happy trails to mention that it's not recent. But Lydia, I know you wanted to mention it.
Yeah, I did, because we've not had the opportunity to mention it yet. But Patsy Lovell, who was Surrey's most capped player, she played for England as well. She was an England selector for all the years that I can remember. She sadly passed away on April the 27th, which was just a week before her 70th birthday. She was awarded an MBE in 2006 for her services to cricket. So really, it was just to acknowledge, obviously, the sadness of her passing, and also what she's done for the women's game. She's been sort of a trailblazer in terms of the time and the effort and what she did on and off the pitch. So obviously sad news, but our thoughts and well wishes are obviously with her friends and family, and of course everyone at Surrey as well.
Nicely done. Very nicely done. So end of episode 2. Do not forget to get those videos to us or information about your club cricketers. We will give you lots of information on how to do that we have done at the start of the podcast, but we want to hear from you. Any questions you have, any comments you want to make, either do it down below on our YouTube channel if you want us to answer them. I think it's down below. It might be again to the left or to the right, which I realized after watching on the first episode that it's actually opposite. So if I go, when you see it on screen, so down to my right or my left, I think that's correct. So put your comments in the sections or get in touch with us on social media, and we're always happy for your input as well. But we're going to be spotlighting some clubs on future editions, and thank you so much for your company as ever.